ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
I think there are a lot of people who will jump to One Nation because they've called time on the system. And what that means is they're not any longer listening to it. And when that happens, it doesn't actually matter what Labor has to say, and it doesn't actually matter what the Coalition has to say.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
The missile launched by China that landed near Tuvalu's waters has demonstrated clearly the contest for power and influence in the Pacific. Very concerning and very destabilising, that's how Defence Minister Richard Marles described it. A provocation, intimidation and unwelcome, that was Opposition Leader Angus Taylor's view. The reach and the timing of this missile is in the centre of attention as the Prime Minister continues his Pacific diplomacy blitz. Welcome to Politics Now. I'm Melissa Clark, filling in for PK.
And I'm Tom Crowley. Good to be with you, Mel.
Nice to be with you, Tom. I know you've been paying close attention to all things Pacific, as it really has been the focus of the government this week. We've had a fortnight of Parliament finish, the midwinter break start, and this has been the opportunity for Anthony Albanese to really press ahead with the government's agenda in lining up stronger security agreements with the Pacific. And having on Monday had put ink to paper on the Oceans of Peace Alliance, this mutual defence treaty with Fiji. We now have the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister in Honiara today looking to progress a security treatment with Solomon Islands. But the timing and intervention of China firing this nuclear-capable missile test in the Pacific yesterday really has put into stark relief what this is all about. I mean, we've seen the government make it clear it's very unhappy with this process, calling it destabilising. The opposition too, some bipartisanship there, calling it very unwelcome. We know the Pacific countries are deeply uncomfortable with this kind of aggression. Test though it may be, Pacific nations are very clear that they want their region to be one of peace. But Tom, what do you make of the timing of this by China? There's been a lot of conjecture about, well, is it a coincidence? Has it been brought forward as a show of force from China? What do you make of what we've heard from China and what we've heard from the Australian government as well?
Enter the intercontinental ballistic missile with a dummy attached. It's a bit of a mouthful. It's a bit irresistible, isn't it? The timing, like it's just one of those things where you don't want to start rampantly speculating, and we must be very responsible about these things and take assurances on face value. But you know, whatever the truth, it almost feels like Occam's razor. I mean, I think you can say that in the broad context, whether the ability to time this precisely with Anthony Albanese's visit to Fiji within hours. I think you guys were recording the podcast yesterday, you and Jacob, in the blissful post-signing world where, as Sitiveni Rambuka had said, oh, we think that China will welcome this. We won't get any significant pushback. And then suddenly, off goes this test. So whether that timing was really lined up, you know, that all seems very cute. But it does, as you say, you know, in the macro, this is clearly the kind of thing that China does to remind people in the region of what it is capable of doing. And the Albanese government's Pacific push is well known. It didn't begin yesterday. This shift in the region and this contest really for these small Pacific nations, but which are almost in a sort of a Cold War style. It's such a cliche to refer to that, but it does have this sphere of influence feel. Australia's foreign policy so geared towards getting as much down on paper as it can, endorsing its own relationships with each of its Pacific neighbours, with the largest in Indonesia, strengthening as well with, you know, Quad partners and countries like Japan and South Korea. But each one of these little partnerships, and last week we had the Vanuatu-Nakamal agreement, which was on the softer end because the Vanuatu local politics are quite divided on this. PNG has always sat on the other end of the scale as just probably the closest leader-to-leader friendship between Anthony Albanese and James Morape and a formal, almost NATO-style alliance. Well, that's now where we've gotten to with Fiji as well. And it always has been all about China. The government, frankly, actually, you know, they come pretty close to saying it directly. And I think Penny Wong, Pat Conroy, Richard Marles, they never actually really blanch at saying, obviously, the context of China is part of this. China knows that too. Everybody knows that that is really what this is about. And so in comes this reminder from China of exactly what their nuclear capabilities are, what their missile capabilities are. It lands, seems quite neatly, perhaps just outside of the ocean economic zone of just about every one of the islands, but really close to several of them, rattling people perhaps. There's talk from the Solomon Islands, new Prime Minister Matthew Wale, about a broader regional alliance. That must make China especially nervous. And so not necessarily targeted at Fiji, but at all of these Pacific nations just to say, well, hey, you know, if you're getting yourself really close to Australia and therefore the US by extension, you know, can we make you a little nervous?
It's an interesting strategy from the Chinese perspective, I think, because as much as it is a reminder of what capabilities China has and its interest and prioritization of the region, it's also a reminder for a lot of Pacific countries that are quite scarred from weapons testing over many decades in the past. It has become quite a formative part of Pacific culture to push back against weapons testing. The push for peace is one that is long-standing over decades, and it's interesting to see. I think it's a challenging effort by China if it is trying to also play the diplomatic game to be having weapons testing directly in this region, you know, dummy warheads landing in waters surrounded by numerous Pacific nations at the same time as trying to, on a diplomatic level, cozy up to these countries and say they're a good development partner, that they are also neighbours in the region. Mm. I think that becomes a harder line for China to walk if it is trying to put on this display. But I guess what we have to take from that is what is the bigger picture here, and ultimately China and also the US are more concerned about their interests than necessarily what is going to work in building good relationships directly with smaller Pacific Island nations. So it becomes a tricky one, but I was a little surprised that we would have that approach from China, because it's just a very blunt way of making a point. And if it is a coincidence, and all the reassurances we're getting from the government and the opposition and other neighbouring countries is that this would have been planned months in advance, you can also hit pause on something. And that also was a decision not taken, which I think, again, from a diplomatic point of view, is quite interesting from China.
I mean, you can hit pause. Also, surely there is, even when you plan these things a long way in advance, there's surely the decision to do it on a Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever, you know, is flexible to some extent. Obviously, I do not have any experience planning missile tests of intercontinental ballistic.
I'm glad you've clarified, Tom. You've got many skills. You never know what you might have tucked away in your CV that I don't know about.
That is thankfully not one of them. But I think, yeah, I mean, you're right. It can play both ways, and maybe in a sense it galvanizes the two opposing camps in Pacific politics. You know, we'll see. But you know, clearly it spooks the horses, both in the sense that it makes it easier for Australia to say, well, this ocean of peace idea that we're pushing, you know, we'd never do a thing like that. And you know that we have a long-standing friendship and partnership, and Australia is really putting out its offer as a NATO-style, you know, defence alliance in the name of peace, which, you know, there's debate about all these sorts of things. But that's really the offering, is that come with us into some sort of military, you know, partnership or security agreement, and that will help us to maintain strategic deterrence, balance in the region, all of that. And then when China does this kind of frightening thing, well, it kind of proves exactly the point. And you're saying, well, this is exactly why we want you to come along with us. But then on the other hand, if you're skeptical about, for instance, the willingness or the reliability of the US as a partner in this region, if you're a Pacific nation, if you're getting a lot of development aid or infrastructure support or other kinds of policing help from China, and then, you know, you see something like this happens, does it just make you want to maintain neutrality and stick your nose out of it? And does it make you afraid of what being too close to Australia will look like? I mean, they're the two ways that you can play it. And as I say, you know, rich debate and opposing camps within the Pacific nations here that, that this might stir.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Vanuatu and the Nakamal Agreement is a good example in one camp. You know, Vanuatu has long considered itself part of the non-aligned movement. So internationally with countries like India that had, you know, determined through the period of, you know, the Cold War era and also in the post-colonial period saw themselves as countries that weren't aligned with colonial forebears, that saw benefit in maintaining relationships with as many countries as possible. And that still run strongly through politics in Vanuatu. I think that's a different scenario from, say, Honiara, where the Prime Minister and Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong are today talking to Matthew Wale, newly elected. We see politics in Solomon Islands swing quite a lot depending on who is in the role of Prime Minister as to how close or how far they want to keep that relationship with China, acknowledging that it is a country that is desperately poor, that is desperately in need of any development it can get. And financial support from China in terms of development assistance comes with infinitely fewer ties and checks and paperwork required than what development assistance from countries like Australia or things like the Asian Development Bank or other institutions offer. It is simply easier for a country with such limited resources to accept often development assistance from countries that ask less of them in return. So it's a really fluid environment. So it's going to be really interesting to see how quickly the Australian and the Solomon's governments can progress those bilateral talks that are now underway. We had Matthew Wale visit Canberra not long after he ascended to the prime ministership. So that we're still very much in the infancy in those talks. They're not going to come away from today's discussions with an agreement, but there does seem to be a real impetus from Matthew Wale to try and progress this quickly. There's now quite a few different templates that can be drawn from with the other countries. So we'll see how much progress they can make in Honiara today. And then, of course, tomorrow we'll have Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape and Tonga's Prime Minister Lord Fakafenua in Brisbane. As they're there, of course, timed with the State of Origin final match.
Naturally.
That will be the opportunity to talk about some of the funding arrangements that are in place for rugby league in the region that have come in a large part because of the arrangements between Australia and Papua New Guinea that sees a Papua New Guinean team enter the NRL. But this is clearly a very intense and concentrated period of time for the Prime Minister, I think it's fair to say, Tom, to try and progress these, and China's actions have just really, literally put a rocket into it.
Yes, yeah. A non-loaded rocket, I suppose. We should keep
emphasizing jokes. Yes.
But yes, I mean, I think it's something that's been bubbling along and that we've talked about occasionally, but probably hasn't really burst much into headline news. But this has probably been the number one, without any really second, foreign policy priority of the Albanese government, and one that in strategic circles they do seem to be getting quite a bit of credit for their statecraft. It's the point's been well made, but it's a really significant contrast to the Morrison government, which found itself in a really desperate situation during the election campaign in 2022, when Sogavare, then the Prime Minister of Solomon Islands, you know, decided to blindside Australia really with a new deal with China, or new conversations with China. And I think what was apparent back then was that, you know, Australia and the government at that time was using words like backyard and had a slightly, what was seen in the Pacific as a diminutive way of talking about Pacific neighbours. It's not a coincidence, I think, that all of the all of these agreements are in Pacific languages, the names of the agreements, and how much, you know, almost over the top the government goes in terms of going over there all the time, spending a lot of time, really high-level ministers, including the Prime Minister, spending a lot of time. We know he walked the Kokoda Trail. You were there with James Marape. The NRL has been a key part of this sort of full court diplomatic press, and those things, you know, don't make all the difference, but that general
gesture
of respect.
It does make a difference, though.
Yeah, the COP as well, and the Pacific event, like, they have really put some significant effort into showing that respect and shifting the tone. I think they would look at this week and say, well, it's paying pretty handsome dividends for us.
I'm really glad you raised that, because I think that's something from the limited experience I've had reporting in the Pacific, particularly going through various meetings of the Pacific Islands Forum in the region. And one of the things that continues to come across is that the leaders of many Pacific countries will note that they are the prime minister or president of their country, and they expect to talk to their counterparts. And so often with the bigger countries, they send a junior minister or they send a departmental official, and you will always get more time and more engagement when the diplomacy that it is happening is at the same level, and there is a lot of respect for the prime minister talking to another prime minister. It's always a frustration of the Pacific when more junior functionaries are sent in place. So I think that's a really good point. But Tom, we'll keep talking about this through the course of the week on politics now, because we're not done yet. But I do want to pick up on something that is bubbling away in the background, and that is the preparations underway for Labor's national conference. So this is their once every 3 year meetings. The party gets together at a national level. They have all their union delegates and delegates from different states and parts of the party to get together to set up the national platform that is meant to set the direction of the Labor Party, what its policy priorities are, what details and direction it wants to go on. I spoke a bit yesterday with Jacob about the New South Wales Labor Conference and some of the state level directions there, particularly the push on gambling. But Tom, I know you've been looking at some of the work that's going on behind the scenes to draft the national policy platform that'll be debated. What's caught your eye?
I think the AI is the most interesting one for me, Mel. I mean, there are a few to choose from. This platform that both matters and doesn't is always just this sort of fascinating and probably pretty thankless exercise for a prime minister, because the only times that we care about what's in the ALP national platform are when it does not concur with where the prime minister and the government are going. That's the only time these things ever matter, is when they clash. And of course, people within the party know that. And although debates within the Labor Party are perhaps not as vibrant and visceral as they once were, and the party culture under Anthony Albanese, sort of various kind or unkind comparisons to Pyongyang and that sort of thing are made sometimes by people who are paying it as a compliment. But that does mean that moments of dissent or moments of just little breakouts of arguments are interesting. And, you know, I think AUKUS and gambling, we understand pretty well the difference that exists among members of the Labor Party and members of the Labor caucus, even on this one. And those are playing out in Parliament quite without needing to be in the national platform. The same really is true with Palestinian statehood. I think the AI one, though, is one where the government is on a really different page to the unions in particular, who I think it's quite notable that the unions, who pretty much got their playbook given to them in the first term of the Labor government when Tony Burke was the employment minister on things like casual contracts and so much else in the IR space, have not been getting their way on what they would like, which is essentially a worker veto to do with automation and the loss of jobs coming from AI. The government has shown no sign that it wants to go anywhere near that. And so I think the question that looms heading into this conference is, not only will some sort of AI language be inserted into the platform that's a little awkward for the government, but what kind of olive branch is it able to offer people within the union movement and the labour movement who are concerned about the impact of AI on jobs? Because the government is in very delicate negotiations, in particular with the company Anthropic. And I think we sometimes understate how significant this is. This is one of the two biggest AI companies in the world at the moment, with, you know, a financial boom that maybe it's a bubble, maybe it's a boom, that OpenAI and Anthropic both heading soon to make their Wall Street debuts. This is a huge moment for those two companies and in the development of a tech that we're all saying is shaping the world. Anthropic is looking at Australia as its answer to a sovereign risk problem, because it's trying to sue the US government. It's getting into all sorts of difficulties with the Trump administration, putting itself out as the progressive and the non-evil AI company, and now looking at Australia for a massive scale-up of the pace of its data centres that it wants, which has some, you know, social licence questions that the government's going to have to contend with. It also wants to be able to train its models on local data, so there's a question about creatives. The government is saying that without heavy-handed regulation and simply by having a good relationship with the company, that it can set a great example of keeping value onshore, getting the Australian economy to benefit, but without any of these sort of frontier risks and real, you know, kind of dangers of AI, and without also the negative byproducts environmentally of data centres that have seen the social licence fraying elsewhere in the world, and which is hurtling towards us as well. So all of that spiel is to say there's a really delicate and consequential for the economy and everything else conversation going on between the government and Anthropic at the moment. And then in comes the union movement at a Labor conference wanting to go further than the government would like it to. It's a really, really challenging one, I think, for them to navigate.
I think it's challenging as well because even within the parliamentary party, the caucus, and even at cabinet level, there are different views about just what the role for government should be. And it's not surprising that there are different views on this, right? This is a brand new sphere of technological interface that we are having to deal with. There aren't roadmaps to go here. It's not surprising that there are different views. And I think the fact that there is a range of views that even at a parliamentary level, the Labor Party is not settled on how it really wants to deal with this does leave it open to persuasion, and unions are seeing that as a possibility. They have had their eye on this for a while. I know at a state level, the unions have been quite strong in campaigning for worker involvement in decisions around AI. There was quite a bit of controversy at the end of last year around New South Wales laws and the extent to which unions should be able to have a say when rosters, for example, are being managed via AI. So the unions are active in this space. They can certainly see that the government has not got a settled position here. And so this is ground and policy ground that is open for persuasion. And I think when it comes to the National Conference, it's been really interesting to see, you know, from 3 year period to 3 year period, the times when those conversations at the conference have been more robust, if we put it politely, and when it's been more cohesive. And I think what we see at the moment, where a lot of this will be settled before we even get to the conference floor, is partly because the factional balance is pretty clear in that where the numbers lie are clear. So effectively, the factions can exert their power before you even get to the conference floor, because you don't need a show of hands and a count to know where the numbers are. The factional balances are clear enough at this point in time that a lot of that negotiating can happen behind the scenes before you get to the floor of the conference, where you go through the process of putting up a motion and have a raise of hands, and there's this very big democratic process of counting numbers, but everyone sort of knows what the outcome is going to be. If we go back, you know, over the last 10 years at least, when I've been to a couple of earlier national conferences, it was a little more uncertain because the factional balance within the ALP, you know, I'm talking between left and right, I'm talking between Victoria and New South Wales, and a lot of the political positioning that goes with those differences in factions were much, much finer. And therefore, if you could convince a couple of votes that go to conference that are based on the youth wing of the Labor Party, or if you could get a couple of votes from the caucus members who have a couple of votes here on behalf of the parliamentary part of the Labor Party, then you might be able to change an outcome. The numbers at the moment are kind of clear enough that generally you know where the outcome will lie. So it's really only a couple of really contentious issues and sort of greenfield issues like AI, and things that are particularly contentious at the moment, where there's always been a bit of differentiation between what the MPs and the parliamentary party thinks and the grassroots thinks. And AUKUS is a key example of this, where there's long been a bit of a divide. They're the issues that will really be the hardest fought over, and we will see a lot of manoeuvring in the next 2 weeks.
I think that's exactly right. And having a dominant prime minister from the left faction, given that that is, you know, the side of the party where so many of the disputes with the front bench come, is a huge part of that. However, though, I think if there is anything counting in the other direction, it's the 94 seats. And I think plenty of the Labor-based people out in the public who say on things like gambling, oh, this Prime Minister hasn't been ambitious enough and, you know, won all of these seats and what are we doing, is a view that is shared, including by people in the parliamentary party, in the caucus. They were happy, I think, some of those sorts of people, with the capital gains and negative gearing happening. But yeah, gambling in particular is just that issue where every single time the PM thinks he can kind of, you know, assert by writ what is going to happen and lay down the law, it feels like a storm is brewing on gambling within the party in particular. I think that we just never have quite got to yet, but that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen soon, now that we've got this legislation as well.
We'll keep a watching brief on it. Tom, it's been great to unpick through all of these issues with you. Thanks so much for joining me on Politics Now.
Thanks, Mel. I'm pleased that I missed the Kylie Minogue podcast ahead of yesterday. It didn't sound like quite as much fun as we've had talking about the Pacific
today.
You don't
want to think about it.
No.
Too much ick.
Oh, yeah. Did you listen to the whole thing? Let's not go there.
I did. But let's not go there again. Let's leave that for now. All right, Tom, thank you very much. And PK will be back in the feed tomorrow. And of course, any questions, send through a voice note to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. Bye, Tom.
See you, Mel.